Okay. Well, you know what? I'm going to just swing us over to the recording mode then, and we can talk casually because I'm going to have to edit this for air later anyway. Okay. Hang on here. Call. I go there. Wait now. This comes here. You go. Can you hear me then?
Yes, I can hear you.
Great. Okay. And you sound really good. All right, Ken, I'm so glad we're having a moment to talk here. Would you introduce yourself?
Yes, my name is Ken Rubin. I'm a professor and the department chair of geology and geophysics at the University of Hawaii, Manoa.
A volcanologist is a person who studies volcanoes. And so that is part of my, it's one of my two main disciplines. My other one is something called geochemistry, which is using the chemistry of the composition of rocks to say something about how they formed.
What do volcanologists think about this current eruption?
So there's two factors that go into any study of an active volcano that is erupting in a place with a human population that could be impacted by the eruption. So once we know that there are humans that could be potentially impacted or human structures, then of course all of the efforts are focused on keeping people safe, figuring out what may or may not happen in the ensuing days or weeks of this eruption, to make plans to mitigate the impacts on people. So there's that aspect, and that is paramount with this eruption, especially because it's happening in a neighborhood. And the other side of it is understanding something about how does the volcano work, and why is this eruption happening the way it is? It's in some ways very similar to an eruption that happened in 1955 in this exact same area, but in some ways completely different than that eruption. And several of us at the university have been sort of debating the historical precedents from the last couple hundred years of historical record at Kilauea, you know, which eruption is this one most like?
That's so cool.
It's fun, and part of the reason for that is because, you know, Kilauea sort of has three main places that it can erupt. It can erupt from its summit, and it's, you know, been currently erupting up there in Halemaumau Crater for more than a decade. And it can also erupt from these two things called rift zones. There's a small southwest rift zone, which kind of extends from the summit down towards the coast in the direction of South Point. And that last erupted in 1974. And then there's this very, very long linear, it's about 40 kilometers long feature we call the East Rift Zone that goes from the summit down to Pu'uo'o and then all the way down into the area where, you know, Pahoa and Kapoho, which is on the coast. And then it continues offshore for another 50 or so kilometers. So it's a long feature. And it's experienced a lot of eruptions over its the period of time that we have historical records of. And what's unusual about this current eruption is that the last two times there was an eruption in this neighborhood, which are 1955, which I mentioned before, and also 1960, which is also known as the Kapoho eruption, and the Lava Trees State Park is in that area, is those two eruptions started down in those sites with similar precursors to this one, meaning some earthquakes and a little bit of ground cracking and some steam coming out of the cracks and then eruption. But the volcano had been quiet before those two eruptions started. Both of those two eruptions, the 1955 and 1960, initiated months to about a year after a short summit eruption. So there was a period of time off where the volcano wasn't erupting. This time, the volcano has been erupting nearly continuously from the area around Pu'uo'o since 1983. And, you know, there's been a couple of periods of time where it's shut off for a little while, or the eruption has migrated a mile or so away from Pu'uo'o. But that's been pretty continuous. And over the last decade, it started to simultaneously erupt at the summit. And the sequence sequence of events that led to the changes that had Pu'uo shutting off, magma draining out of it, having a collapse of the cone and a huge earthquake, and then the migration of earthquakes down the rift zone towards the Leilani Estates area. That's a sequence that we haven't seen before.
Seems like a pretty sort of a logical sequence, especially when you describe it that way, right?
Right. So then this is the context. And what's really interesting is, if you remember back to April 20th, 21st, 22nd, we started hearing reports from the Hawaii Volcano Observatory that the crater in Hale Mau Mau, there's something called Overlook Crater, which is where the lava lake is, was filling up. And so that crater, the level of lava in that thing, it's kind of like a pressure valve in a sense. Sometimes the lava is a couple hundred feet below the rim. Sometimes it's closer up to the rim. It had some spectacular overflows of the crater where lava reached the top, kind of like getting into a bathtub, and then it spills out over the sides a couple of years ago. But sort of leading up to the sort of events that happened before the migration of activity down to Lower Puna, we saw an inflation of the volcano, and this is something they can see using both satellites and also instruments on the ground that show how one piece of ground is moving relative to another. And just like a sort of a blister that is filling with fluid, the volcano was inflating, and lava overtopped the edges of this crater and caused a huge amount of lava outflowing onto the floor of Hale Mau Mau. And so this suggested that the supply of magma to the volcano was increasing. And we also saw the supply of magma at Pu'uo'o increasing. So remember, this is roughly 2 weeks ago. And so the magma level at Pu'uo'o, which also has a crater in it and also sometimes has what we call a lava lake, that started rising up and filling. So both sites were inflating at the same time, which is a little bit unusual. Normally, either one or the other will inflate, but not both. And so in that context, even before we saw the dramatic events that initiated on May 1st, we already saw that the volcano was engorged with magma. And that's the whole context. We don't really understand yet the relationship between all of this extra magma filling into the volcano and then all of a sudden the shutting down of Pu'uo'o, the large earthquakes, the migration of small earthquakes down to Lower Puna. That last thing is a manifestation of what we call an intrusion, and that's just a fancy word for magma moving in the subsurface. So when magma moves along these cracks in the earth along the so-called rift zone, it makes little earthquakes as it goes along the way. I can tell you a story about, you know, Pu'uo'o, which is the primary site of the eruption for the last 35 years now. I was told that when they came up with the name, people were looking at a map of Hawaii, and the words East Rift Zone were written on the map, and it turned out that the cone that was being built at that site was right under the letter O, where it said East Rift Zone. And so it was building a hill, and the scientists who were studying it at the time decided to call it Pu'uo, and that then they changed it to Pu'uo'o, and that's how it got its name.
So we're talking about a huge amount of magma that was at Overlook Crater at Pu'uo'o. You know it's on the move, and then it somehow comes up 11 and a half miles away?
Right. So this is something that was very hard to predict exactly where it was going to come up. And so the one thing that we know about the Pu'uo'o eruption, it is along this rift zone. The rift zone, for most of its length, is a very linear feature. However, sort of right up at its extreme western end, it makes kind of a bend into the caldera. And so there's been a couple of famous eruptions that happened higher up along the rift zone, including the Mauna Ulu eruption, which happened in the early 70s. There was also the Kilauea Iki eruption that happened just before that, up in that area. But around Pu'u'o'o, over this 35 years, there's a couple of times the eruptive activity has migrated to something called Napau Crater, which is just a couple of miles to the west of Pu'u'o'o. And it's also migrated to a place called Kupainaha. And the eruption's been sort of has migrated back and forth between those sites that are all kind of within, I don't know, 3 or 4 miles of each other for most of its history.
What about underwater magma?
There are eruptions that happen on the East Rift Zone. It continues offshore, and when it moves offshore, we call it Puna Ridge. And we know there have been eruptions there. We see the features of volcanism on Puna Ridge. There's also, of course, when lava flows across the surface of the land and then meets the sea, we see that happening. That's been going on off and on at Pu'u'o'o for a significant part of the eruption history. That's a fairly explosive process, usually, and can actually be quite hazardous. But when magma is erupted underwater, meaning it starts underwater, as long as the water depth is deeper than a couple hundred feet, it really starts to change the character of the eruption. It's a lot less explosive. It makes a different kind of lava, something that we call pillow lava.
Hmm. Does it seem as though there's a lot more lava on the move now than there was the last time we had a, what was it, 2015 or 16?
It's very, very difficult to quantify the amount of magma that's moving. How much magma that is being added to the volcano is actually erupting out the top, and how much of it is staying internally in the volcano? And when magma stays internally within the volcano, it causes one or another kind of deformation. Either the ground lifts up like a blister, or the ground spreads apart. And the way Kilauea is constructed, it's basically sitting on the side of Mauna Loa volcano, and there's a detachment surface between those two, and the south flank of the volcano, of Kilauea volcano, which is sort of everything on the south side of the East Rift Zone, is slowly moving to the ocean, and that accommodates the addition of the magma. So it's very hard to say if there's more magma moving now than in previous migration events, because there's a lot of data to look at still, and, you know, that will help tell us how much was injected into the volcano versus how much is being erupted. Now, the other important thing about the way Kilauea seems to work is that the slopes are relatively gentle on the volcano, and just a slight difference in where a volcanic vent is determines a lot about where the lava is going to flow. The lava, just like water, flows downhill, and you know you can measure where all the drainages are, and you know calculate with some precision that if an eruption happens in one place or another, where is it probably going to flow? But we don't always know where the ground cracking is going to happen. And so, for instance, in the what we call the Kamoa-Moa 1 and 2 eruptions, the Kamoa-Moa 2 was the one that eventually sent that long lava flow down into Pahoa. That sequence of events initiated in 2013. It continued into 2014. If you recall, the lava made it into Pahoa late part of the year, November, I believe, of 2014, and continued sort of slowly up through the early parts of 2015.
And I guess there's so many different ways that earthquakes and volcanoes kind of interact. I mean, it's how a volcano could cause an earthquake, how an earthquake could, like, trigger more eruption phases or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's, you know, at least globally, there's a lot of interaction between those. So sometimes we'll see when we have one of these very, very large earthquakes somewhere, that it can set off earthquakes at other sites, and also volcanic eruptions at other sites, or at least there's some correlation in time.
Do you feel there's some correlation between, we had an eruption, I guess it was maybe 2011, and then Japan had a giant earthquake as well?
The these are very difficult questions to answer in reality. It's not clear that externally triggered events like earthquakes that are happening around the Pacific, for instance, have really any role in how the volcano behaves. It's already erupting the way it is. And maybe another way to look at it is you look at Mauna Loa volcano, which for much of the historical period of time in Hawaii has actually been, you know, very active, and it hasn't erupted since 1984. And in fact, 1984 is one of the only few occasions that we know of Kilauea and Mauna Loa erupting at the same time. Usually it's one or the other. But that volcano has had a couple of episodes, including one that ended just a couple of years ago, where the volcano was inflating and there were lots of earthquakes up near the summit and the upper part of its southwest rift zone. And scientists were watching it thinking, ooh, maybe this thing could erupt. And so it was pressurized and kind of ready to go, and yet all these earthquakes that have happened around the world, large ones, haven't had any effect at all on Mauna Loa. In fact, it didn't erupt. The magma seems to have sort of resorbed back into the volcano, and it's still primed for an eruption at some point, but we have no idea knowing when. And the point being that the earthquakes that are happening both on the Big Island and elsewhere in the Pacific have not been enough to trigger something there.
Uh-huh. And you wouldn't be surprised at, say, a 6.9 or that size of earthquake associated with a volcano, I mean, as we had last week.
Well, so that's a really big one. There was an even bigger one in the 70s, in the 7s. And, there's sort of two kinds of earthquakes that we have here in Hawaii. There are the earthquakes that are related to magma moving in the subsurface and or the volcano kind of shifting to adjust itself. And that's what that big earthquake was last week, and that was unusually large. And there are also earthquakes that happen. So, the Hawaiian Islands are built on a big, thick slab of crust called the Pacific Plate, and this is formed down in the extreme eastern part of the Pacific Ocean, and this plate is moving by, and by the time it gets to the vicinity of Hawaii, it's already, in the neighborhood of 70 or 80 million years old, and then the Hawaiian Islands are built on them. And so if you imagine a structure as big as Mauna Loa and Mauna Kea volcanoes together, it represents a huge amount of weight that gets piled up on this plate. And every once in a while, the faults within that plate readjust, and we get a deep earthquake. The earthquake that happened off of Kauai High about 10 years ago and caused a fair amount of destruction, that was a very large earthquake, and that happened. That was the mechanism there. But at a place like Kilauea, where it's actively erupting, there's also several different kinds of earthquakes that can happen. So when magma comes up into relatively shallow parts of the volcano, meaning, just a couple thousand feet deep, and then it starts moving around, that causes high frequency and small earthquakes. So the magnitude of them are relatively small, and they're felt only very locally, but there are a lot of them. And when they're migrating, when they move from one place to another, we usually call that a swarm. And that usually suggests that magma is moving along with the quakes. And one way that we know that is by, at the same time, looking at the deformation of the ground. Is the ground moving up or down? Is it spreading apart along cracks? That helps tell us that there's something in there. Those earthquakes tend to be really, really small. Now, there's also earthquakes that happen at Kilauea that are more related to adjustments of the volcano when pressure builds up over many years from adding magma to the volcano, spreading to accommodate that added magma.
What would cause a tidal wave? Has that ever happened in Hawaii history, that our own earthquake caused a tidal wave we had to deal with?
It has, and so you know, tidal waves or tsunami is the term we prefer to use these days. How they form is if you have a rapid change in the location of the seabed somewhere, and this change can, it's usually an up or down change, like if the seabed suddenly jumps up or it drops down, that puts a wave of pressure into the ocean. And these waves, you know, we know about, for instance, the Indian Ocean tsunami that happened back in the early 2000s. When there's a large amount of energy that's put into the ocean, they can travel all around the oceans, and the pressure wave goes all the way from the surface of the ocean all the way down to the bottom. And the only time we actually see it manifested is when you get close to a shoreline, because you're forcing all that energy to compress into a thinner and thinner sort of stack of water, and that's what causes the water to rise up and inundate the land. Now, there have been, at Kilauea Volcano, several well-known local tsunami, meaning shifts in the land that have happened, all related to various bits of activity at Kilauea Volcano, have caused local generation of these same sorts of waves that have inundated areas very close by. So, for instance, you've heard, you know, when the lava is flowing to the ocean, as it had been doing for quite some time off of Pu'uo'o in the Kupainaha area, it makes a rocky delta that sticks out into what had been the ocean, and at its base, it's not connected very well to, what is the former seabed. The seabed there is full of a lot of broken up rock, sand, and also something we call hyalloclastite, which is when lava interacts with water in a shallow environment, it breaks up into lots of little pieces, and it makes a kind of a granular material, which isn't very strong. And when enough weight is put on that by building up a new land mass, every once in a while those things collapse away. And when they collapse away, they can produce, you know, fairly big waves that can then come back in and inundate the coastline. And this is something that it's one of the significant hazards. It's nearly impossible to predict when they're going to happen. But in all cases, when you do have a tidal wave or tsunami, the kind of common feature is that something has to change about the seabed so that when you have a 6.9 earthquake or a magnitude 5 earthquake and it happens on the island and not offshore, then unless there's a corresponding kind of up and down motion on the seafloor, you probably won't generate a tsunami.
So that's what kind of happened with the 6.9, huh?
Exactly. It was, I mean, it's a big one, and the location, you know, what we call the epicenter, which is basically the location on the ground surface that's above where the rupture occurred, which usually happens, you know, deep in the earth for the earthquake. They've been having some difficulty picking the exact location of the epicenter, so that's still moving around. But it looks like it's up on the volcano itself, and so that may have played somewhat of a role in, you know, whether or not a tsunami was going to be generated. But, you know, the Richter scale, which is what the original sort of earthquake magnitude scale was developed from, it's now moved on from the Richter scale to something a little bit more sophisticated, but the numbers are factors of 10. So like when you have a magnitude 5 and a magnitude 6, the magnitude 6 is 10 times as strong. So that earthquake was a very strong earthquake, but the sense of motion of the earthquake was a little bit more sliding than up and down, and so that's another contributor to perhaps, you know, why it didn't make a tsunami.
Volcanoes, climate change, I mean, do we want to have to say anything there?
Volcanoes, over the history of the Earth, had been one of the primary drivers of climate on the planet, in both ways of warming and cooling the planet. And that is, the warming mechanism is by pumping carbon dioxide out, and it takes a lot of volcanism over a long period of time to significantly affect global climate. There have been periods of time in Earth's past where there have been large outpourings of lava that maybe last a million years. We call these flood basalts. There's one in the northwestern United States called the Columbia River flood basalt, for instance. When those happen, there are periods of warming on the planet. There's also episodes of cooling associated with volcanism. They tend to be very short, meaning you can get cooling that lasts 2 or 3 years after an eruption. And these come from what we call sulfate aerosols. These are particles of oxygenated sulfur that condense in the atmosphere. So something like a Mount Pinatubo, which erupted in the Philippines in 1991, or Mount St. Helens, when they erupt very violently, they inject ash particles and sulfate aerosols up into the stratosphere. These things then sort of spread out around the globe, and those particles reflect light back out to Earth. It's a temporary process, but we can see global cooling for a few years. Kilauea doesn't seem to erupt that way. Even its most famous and large explosive eruptions, there was one in the early 1900s, and there was also one in the late 1700s, don't produce ash columns that are big enough and tall enough to get up into the stratosphere, so it probably doesn't contribute at all to cooling. And the carbon dioxide that's coming out of Kilauea, it's to a first order fairly constant over time, since the volcano is essentially always erupting, or very nearly always erupting in our historical observations of it, which means that whatever effect it does or doesn't have on the climate is kind of already dialed in, right? It's already always sort of doing what it does, putting a tiny bit of extra carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm. And I feel from your earlier comments like the relationship between Kilauea right now and sort of, I guess it's called the Ring of Fire, right? You don't see them as too closely related? I mean, there's a handful erupting all around the Pacific Rim right now. I think 10 or 12 of them.
So what's interesting, and there's a really excellent website that's run through the Smithsonian Institution. It's called the Global Volcanism Program. And they kind of keep track of, they
right.
interact with volcano observatories around the world. They keep sort of records of what's going on at any given time. They send out a weekly report. And the reality is that there's pretty much always about 10 or 20 volcanoes going off somewhere on the planet. And sometimes they're in places that people notice, and sometimes they're in places that people don't notice. So that there's this kind of perception, I think, amongst the general population that we have these periods of time where there's a lot of volcanism and other periods of time when there isn't. But the reality is it isn't really quite like that. There's almost always activity going on. It's just a question of whether or not it's in the news.
That's good to know, right? I mean, the current eruption we have going on right now at Kilauea, can you at all tell what you would expect, number one, and what would start worrying you?
Volcanoes hold lots of surprises, and I don't think any of us who study Kilauea, would say with any certainty what it could or couldn't do in the future and what a dangerous eruption in the future might look like. What we can say are what are the most extreme things that have happened in this volcano in the last few hundred years when we've been observing it, and those most extreme things are things that could potentially be very dangerous, more hazardous than what we've seen so far with this latest phase of the eruption in Leilani Estates. It's not super useful to speculate, though, to people to say, oh, well, it could be even worse, or the volcano could be doing this thing.
Sure, but I mean, what has happened before? Honestly, I don't know. What you're talking about, creeping lava flows in terms of destruction, has it ever been too very different from how it is now?
It has. There have been several periods of time where the volcano seems to have erupted less frequently and more explosively. And so when it erupts explosively, it sends a large column of material up into the air. This is a particulate, volcanic ash, that then falls back on the landscape. The blasts associated with that can be fairly intense. Also what we call ballistics, which are kind of large chunks of rocks that get thrown out of the volcano. Those can happen. The big one was in the 1790s, and this one was believed to be, so there was a period of time, and the folks over at the Volcano Observatory have been studying this now in detail for about the last 10 years. There's a guy over there named Don Swanson, that this was the project that he focused on. He used to be the head of HVO, where the volcano was in a phase sort of in the 1400s, 1500s, and 1600s, where it wasn't erupting all the time like it is now. And so there was a lot more groundwater up around the summit. You know, it rains a lot up there. It's relatively wet, and the ground wasn't as hot, and so it became saturated with water. And then when magma started to fill back into the volcano, it interacts with that. And magma and water interacting can make a very explosive combination. There's this sort of immediate flashing to steam. There's a huge expansion associated with that, and that causes, fairly violent activity. And so this 1790s eruption was thought to have been initiated that way, sort of magma coming back into the volcano and it transitioning from a phase of infrequent eruption up in the summit area to more frequent eruption in the summit area, and this is what initiated that explosive activity. The same can be said at a smaller degree for the explosive eruption that happened in the 1920s at Kilauea. In history of the unification of the islands of Hawaii, you've probably heard the story that King Kamehameha, when he was just one of the chiefs on the Big Island, they were about to have a battle, and the volcano erupted and took out a whole bunch of the competing armies' warriors. That was all part of this sequence of events that happened in the, the 1790s.
Oh, that's so cool. That really is.
Yeah, so there's, the relationships between what happens at the volcano and the Hawaiian belief system and recording of events and, attributing activity, especially Kilauea, to Pele and, sort of various things that were going on with her over time, I think, that is a very interesting link that is part of what makes it so interesting to study volcanoes in Hawaii.
No one knows how long this is going to last. It was 88 days, right, for the eruption in the 50s.
There was another one in 1960. That one lasted 36 days. And then the only other time that there's been eruptive activity to the east of Pu'u'o was in 1977. There was an eruption kind of a little bit downrift of Kupainaha, and that one lasted 18 days. So, I think those three give us some idea, a reasonable idea of the kind of bookends that this eruption, it's likely that it's going to go on for a couple of weeks. But we don't know. We could be surprised, and the volcano, it could stop erupting down there in Leilani States tomorrow. The one thing that, we're watching the data, there's real-time monitoring coming out of the observatory, and one thing that they've noticed in the last day or so is that the frequency of earthquakes has gone down a little bit in the area, and the volcano is continuing to sort of deflate again after that big inflation event. So they're not sure, they're very cautious about interpreting that as a pause or not in the migration of magma down the rift. But at least in the short term, it does look like, maybe magma is not going down rift to the Leilani site as intensely as it was last week, in which case that could be a good sign that maybe the eruption down there won't last very long, as long as these other three that have happened before.
Mm-hmm. Who knows, right? I hope you don't mind if we'll be checking in with you occasionally, Ken. It's been really great talking with you.
Sure. Yep. No. Happy to chat. One of the things that I think is very important for everyone in Hawaii, but especially people who live in that area, to be aware of is that it is a volcanically active area. There are hazard maps that the U.S. Geological Survey has put out, and really the hazards are determined by the frequency of eruptive events in each little sort of square bit of land over there on the Big Island, and probabilities, meaning how far away is any piece of land from a place that erupts, how frequently does that place erupt, and how likely is there to be an eruption impact in this place. And there's 9 different levels to the hazard map, with things that are lower than level 4, sort of, so the highest hazard is in hazard 1, and hazard 9 is the lowest hazard. And so things like hazard zones 5 through 9, there really isn't much hazard. There's always a little bit of hazard, but it's relatively small. But hazard zone, this eruption is happening in hazard zone 1. It's got a very, very high probability of eruption. And we know this from this recent prehistory. And certainly old-timers who had lived in that part of Puna, or their family has lived in that part of Puna for generations, have stories to tell about each one of these other eruptions and what the impacts were on the community. And it's important for people to remember that, to know what those hazards are. When new people move in, I was recently looking at some statistics, and the Puna district is the fastest growing area on the Big Island in terms of people moving in and so forth. And as long as people are aware of what has happened in that area in the recent past, and is it's the responsible thing is to know how to live with and mitigate the impacts of eruptions that might happen in their area, then I think